This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1969, Howard Lee made history. He was elected mayor of Chapel Hill, first African-American to run a predominantly white southern town in the post-Reconstruction era. That job was just the beginning of Lee's career in public service. He served in the state Senate and in a cabinet as a cabinet executive. Today, more than four decades later, Howard Lee continues his work for higher educational standards and to improve health for the state's youth. Howard Lee joins us now on The State of Things. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Mike. I'm delighted to be with you.
It's good to have you, and we're going to invite our friend, the political junkie, Ken Rudin, with us. He has followed Howard Lee's career for many years and always enjoys talking with him. Ken Rudin, welcome.
Thanks. I'm thrilled to be here, too.
Howard Lee, let's talk about your beginnings. You were born and raised in Georgia. Tell us about coming up in Georgia in those years.
Well, it was a very tough time, but it was also one that I think contributed handsomely to the person I turned out to be, because it challenged me in such a way that it prepared me for many of the challenges that would come later in life. But it was a very dangerous time, and I often refer to the fact that each morning I got out of bed, like so many people who lived in that little small town, I felt as if I was walking a gauntlet, and I didn't quite know if I'd come out the other end. But when I look back at those days, certainly I think the growth that I experienced was very much rooted in that experience.
You walked that gauntlet, you learned to be careful, and yet you took risks. You challenged a whites-only rule at a rail station when you were a young man. Tell us that story.
Well, absolutely. I had become very upset about the fact that there was repression and that watching older blacks being mistreated, and one day I decided to, when I needed to go to the bathroom, I decided I didn't like the colored bathroom, so I went to the white men's bathroom, got away with that, but then I took it a little farther and went to a white female's bathroom, and that was not smart. That's when I got in real trouble. But that experience totally changed my life. I was roughed up by a group of Klansmen, got away, obviously. And at that moment, I changed my plans from preparing to leave the South and get as far away as I could, going to New York or some other place, and decided that my place was in the South and I would continue to stay and fight as much as I could against the injustices that was going on. And so here I am.
Well, now, wait a minute. That's perverse. How did getting beaten up in the South encourage you to stay when you'd already made up your mind to leave?
Well, I decided that it was totally unacceptable that this being my hometown, that the only way I felt I could find success in life would be to leave. And I just simply was not going to let anybody run me out of my hometown. I did get smarter as a result of that, and I've learned how to take on the system without taking it head on. And that's when I developed skills on how to maneuver through the system.
Well, let's talk about some of that education and skills development. You did go into the Army after college, and even there you realized that this was a place where the same kinds of things that were going on in Georgia were happening to you in the Army as well.
Well, absolutely. I by going in the Army and being stationed at Fort Hood, Texas, which is located near Killeen, Texas, the same environment existed that I had left back in Georgia. I had gone into town one Saturday morning and asked for a cup of coffee at the local drugstore and was told that I couldn't be served. And being a soldier and giving up 2 years of my life, I felt that I certainly couldn't accept that. So I organized a protest, but the general found out that I had done that and called me and all of my comrades into his office and confined us to the base for the weekend. But on Monday morning, I had orders to go to Korea. And so I didn't have any problems with discrimination and repression in Korea.
But even though it was South Korea.
Even though it was South Korea.
Yeah, so that was one way to handle that. But again, you're still organizing. I mean, it is interesting to me that and I understand that you were inspired by what happened in Greensboro, the Greensboro sit-in.
Oh, yes. That was probably the greatest influence on my thinking at that time. I really resented the fact that I was in the Army while all of these college students were out here having fun with sit-ins and protests, which is what I really wanted to do. But that did have an influence on me. But it was also one that gave me hope, and that, too, was extremely important. But then when you taste freedom and then you lose it again. That is a tough pill to swallow. So when I came back from Korea and settled in as a probation officer in Savannah, Georgia, I found myself right back in the oppressive, discriminatory environment where I was paid $100 less than my white counterparts in the juvenile justice system. And at that time, of course, Dr. King and Hosea Williams and a lot of civil rights activists, Andy Young, were working in Savannah, and so that gave me an excuse to have a backdoor involvement with that.
And how did you become involved?
Well, I was in charge of putting juveniles in the probation system who were arrested as a result of protests. And so we devised a system to get them out, bring them in the front door, process them in, and then get them out of the back door so they could get back on the line. We did that until I got caught, and then, of course, we had to back up.
This seems to be the beginnings of your ability to work ingeniously within and without the system, it seems to me. You're actually defending a system of criminal justice that's working against African Americans, but you have a kind of a subversive effect because you're part of it now.
Well, I certainly think that there are always ways to be helpful within the system without doing damage to any other group. I've always said that I will never engage in a process of racializing a problem because I think people are impacted in the same sort of way. In the work that I'm doing now, for example, while I recognize that black boys probably are experiencing the worst in public schools and are performing at the lowest levels for a number of reasons, I still think that the minority ethnic group that we have to be concerned about is that confined in the socioeconomic realm, because there are a lot of white boys who are experiencing the same thing the black boys are experiencing, and white families are experiencing the same thing. But then I reflect back on my early life where we lived in an environment where we lived next door to whites. We got along well. They would borrow items from us and we from them. But the difference was during that day is white families thought they were better than black families and didn't accept that they were being treated just as poorly even then. Today, it's even worse.
Ken, I know you have some questions for Howard Lee.
Well, I was thinking, nobody seemed to pay attention to black political power until 1967 when Carl Stokes was elected mayor of Cleveland. I guess Richard Hatcher was elected mayor of Gary, Indiana, the same year. So the idea of blacks in political office seemed to be on people's minds. And then comes the assassination of Dr. King in 1968. Howard Lee, obviously that had a profound effect on you. Tell us how.
Well, I had certainly been encouraged by the success of both Carl and Richard. Richard became a very close friend later on. I didn't get to know Carl that well. But that gave hope to me that we were at least moving in the right direction. I had tried to buy a house in Chapel Hill, which is known as a liberal community, and no realtor in Chapel Hill would sell me a house. We finally ended up buying the house with working with a white family in Chapel Hill by tricking the realtor. We moved in, and for 1 year, my wife and I lived under threats of death with our children. I asked the city council in Chapel Hill to pass an open housing ordinance, and they simply refused to do it. I decided, since I was at Duke University working at the time, to concentrate on my career. And then Dr. King was assassinated. And that assassination drove me back to the city council to make a second request, which was turned down. And it was on that basis that I decided, well, at least I can run for an office, the office being mayor. I can lay these issues out for public debate, and maybe through that we can get the positive outcome. And, of course, I made all these promises, and then I got elected, and I had to carry out all the things I said I was going to do. But that's how I suspect if Dr. King had not been assassinated, I probably would not have given serious consideration to running for mayor at that time.
So tell me about how did you approach then that campaign?
Well, I had a very close friend whose name was Bowie Sewell. Bowie's father had been Attorney General in North Carolina and had made a reputation of fighting the Klan in North Carolina. and had been threatened. And Bowie himself was a Presbyterian minister who lived in Chapel Hill. And he was one noted for challenging the system. And so he pushed me to seriously consider running for mayor. And the way he roped me into it, because I was really hesitant to do it, is he went to a local newspaper, Chapel Hill Weekly at the time, and the editor was a fellow by the name of Jim Shoemaker. He went to Jim and said, I've got a rumor that Howard Lee is going to run for mayor and be the first black to try to become mayor of Chapel Hill. Well, surprisingly, Shoemaker did not check it out. He just simply published the story, and it split Chapel Hill down the middle. And I had people saying, don't do it, others saying, rah, rah, this is a great day. To make a long story short, Billy Barnes and Ann Barnes, two very close friends, decided that if I ran, they would manage the campaign. And we organized Chapel Hill like it had never been organized before by using students from the university and faculty, and also bringing students in from around the state, using somewhat of a civil rights tactic of getting people to come from the outside to help us inside. And we were able to organize in such a way that we assured we'd have our votes at the poll, which is very similar to what the Obama campaign was able to do on a much, much larger scale.
Talking with Howard Lee, a North Carolina leader dedicated to public service for all of his career, political junkie Ken Rudin is with me, and you're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our conversation continues in a moment. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and today talking with former Chapel Hill mayor, former North Carolina senator, also a member of the cabinet here in the state, Howard Lee, and political junkie Ken Rudin is with us as well. And Ken, you know, we were talking about that race in 1969. Howard Lee talks about running for mayor. You know, what did you make of it? And if you had a chance to ask Howard Lee any question at all, and you do, what would you ask?
Well, I mean, you mentioned the race, and race is the key word there, because if you remember, when Howard Lee was elected mayor of Chapel Hill, there was African-American politicians around the country trying to take advantage of the Carl Stokes and the Richard Hatchers and even the Charles Evers, who's the mayor of Fayette, Mississippi at that time. But at the same time, Tom Bradley was trying to run for mayor of Los Angeles in 1969, and he lost to Sam Yorty in a brutal, bitter, ugly contest that was about race. And this is Los Angeles. This is not Jackson, Mississippi. This is not the headquarters of the Klan. This was in Los Angeles, where racial tactics were seen so evidently and so upfront in Sam Yorty's reelection campaign in 1969. And yet, when Howard Lee was elected mayor in Chapel Hill, you said it was predominantly white. It was overwhelmingly white. Yet it didn't have the sense of a racial campaign, even though history was being made.
It was not a racial campaign, and I and my associates really worked very hard to try and keep race at a minimum, even though some people from the outside tried to come in and inject race in it. I had one person who came in with a pot of money and said, I'd like to put some money in your campaign, and he had gone to the local newspaper with an ad that was just absolutely laden with racism. And we've learned about it because Shoemaker said, I'm not running this unless you guys tell me you're happy with it. So we pulled that ad, gave the person his money back that he contributed to the campaign, and we cut our ties. So we kept it above that because my opponent, a fellow by the name of Roland Gittes, had a long history in Chapel Hill. His father had been not only a professor at the university, but Roland himself had been a progressive. But over time, he tended not to have the kind of ideas that Chapel Hill needed to have injected at that moment. And because of him and because of me, we kept it focused on the issues and not on the personalities.
What I'm, as a political junkie, though, what I'm so fascinated about is the history involved in it, because right as you were being elected, the numbers were just outstanding nationwide. 1/5 of 1% of all the public officials elected in the country were African American. 1,100 blacks in public office in 1969 out of 521,759. Now, we'll talk about how the country and the South certainly has evolved since 1969, but again, we won't have to. You don't have to focus on race. The campaign didn't focus on race, but just as those people who love sports and love the first this and the first that, Chapel Hill in 1969 was historic.
It was historic, and of course, it was so historic that I have newspaper clippings from at least 14 foreign countries in languages I can't read that pronouncing that success. And of course, some people have tried to minimize the impact of Chapel Hill because of Chapel Hill's liberal image that obviously came out of the university. But Chapel Hill had a very discriminatory population to the extent that when I arrived in Chapel Hill in 1964, there was one little small recreational area for blacks, and there had been a group called the Exchange Club that had built a segregated swimming pool and, of course, did not allow blacks to attend. And the black citizens in Chapel Hill did not have access to the university facilities. And then there was one of the hot issues that was in the Chapel Hill race centered around a big old hole that existed in the middle of the black community on a street called Mitchell Lane, where all of the oil and dirt and cans were dumped into that hole. And it was a danger for kids. And the town had been asked to prepare that hole for years, and they totally ignored it. So one of the first things I did when I became mayor was to repair that hole. The other is, if you look at the streets that had been paved, streets in Chapel Hill had been paved up to the black community and not in the black community. Water and sewer had been extended up to the black community and not in the black community. And there had not been a new house built in the predominant black community area in years, although there were houses being built in some other areas of Chapel Hill. So Chapel Hill reputation and image was not the most positive when it came to racial balancing. But I will say this, the mayor of Chapel Hill, Sandy McClamrock, who preceded me, was a person, along with the chief of police, Bill Blake, during the civil rights era, really worked to try to be fair and balanced in the way everybody was treated in Chapel Hill. But there was some nasty, nasty events in Chapel Hill during the civil rights era. In one place, the waitress urinated in a bucket and poured it over the heads of several demonstrators who were sitting in at the time. So there's some ugliness in the Chapel Hill community that were prevalent at that time that many people were unhappy about.
You decided to run for Congress in 72. Tell us about that decision.
I did. I had been encouraged to consider running for Congress when Nick Galifianakis was planning to run for the U.S. Senate. And it was a district that was tailor-made, Durham, Raleigh, Chapel Hill. I felt most people felt in 72 were ready to elect a black to Congress. The legislature got wind of this and took Chapel Hill in Orange County and removed it from the old 4th District away from Chapel Hill, from Durham and Raleigh, and put it in the 2nd District with all of the eastern North Carolina rural counties, making it a 12-county district that was bigger than the state of Maryland. Interestingly enough, it was the same district in which George White had served during his last stint in Congress, who left Congress in 1901, and George White had served, the last congressman in the South, had served in that 2nd district.
An African-American.
Yes. George,
yeah.
Yeah.
That is interesting. I didn't realize that. But now you're talking about a gerrymandered district by a Democratic legislature, right?
Oh, yes.
The Democratic-controlled legislature that basically gerrymandered you out of or made it difficult for you.
Yes. There was no love lost with blacks in the Democrat Party at that time.
At that time.
I mentioned this to Howard the last time we spoke. It's just so indelibly fixed in my mind. I'm driving through North Carolina on the way to Florida, and this was 1972 during Howard Lee's primary against Congressman L.H. Fountain. And around his district on 95, there was this huge billboard, and it said, fight communism and integration, join the United Clans of America. And I'm saying, my goodness, why is there a billboard like this in right here. And then I realized just later, and that's why Howard Lee has always been part of my collective historical memory, because one, Howard Lee was running for Congress at that time in a district that was 40% African American, but also 1972, George Wallace was on the ballot running for president in the North Carolina primary the same day. So as much as Howard Lee's goal to bring out new black voters and to change the registration and change the odds in his favor, you also had George Wallace on the ballot, and God knows who the Wallace campaign brought out to vote for him on his behalf and how that may have helped Congressman Fountain.
One of the old ghosts from the past came back during that campaign, and that is the buying and selling of the black vote. In some of the eastern counties, there were blacks who sold themselves out, took money, and then voted, either didn't go to the polls, discouraged people from going to the polls, and that hurt very much as well.
I want to fast forward a little bit in your career, Howard, and talk about working for Governor Hunt. You were what is now, I guess, the predecessor to the Department of Environment and Natural Resources.
Yes, that's correct.
What did you do there? What was that job all about?
Well, Governor Hunt had asked me to join his cabinet, and he was thinking initially that he would ask me to serve as Secretary of Health and Human Services. But at the last minute, he decided that he'd like to have me head up the Department of what at that time was Natural Resources and Economic Development. It was an interesting experience because it threw me into an area that would traditionally not be receptive of a black person. And, of course, what I found when I got in there is that there were not a whole lot of blacks in any of these areas. And I was warned that I might not be well accepted by some of the primary folk in these areas. The first thing I did, to Governor Hunt's dismay, is I decided I would have a meeting with the marine fisheries, and I'd call all the fishermen together. And when he learned that, he called and said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" Well, we did, and I went down, and every fisherman in the eastern part of the state apparently showed up for that meeting because they were hanging out of the windows when I got there. Now, to show you how dumb I am, I walked in a three-piece suit with cufflinks and fully dressed, and here are these guys who just got off boats were sitting there. I did make one move, and that is I took off my coat, took off the vest, took off the tie, and rolled up my sleeves, and I gave them a proposal that how we could work together to achieve what they wanted, because I had learned that the fishermen had not felt they were being treated fairly and that they'd been discriminated against. And so when I finished, I got a standing ovation, and that was the beginning of a strong working relationship with the fishermen. I did the same thing with forestry, and of course, for me, I don't know if we could have designed a better opportunity for me to expand my outreach in the state of North Carolina and break down old racial barriers with groups of people who ordinarily would not be receptive, and had strong support, and the experience was great during that time. The one thing that was really troubling for both of us, both Governor Hunt and me, is that I was expected to be everything to every black person in the state of North Carolina. And so when they had problems or concerns, they'd come to me. And the one issue that really was plaguing us early on before we could actually get started was the Wilmington 10. And the pressure was on to get those kids out of jail and to put that behind us. And Governor Hunt and a lot of his advisors and I came up with a compromise that didn't satisfy a lot of the blacks. But I had to go out and sell it, and we did, and we got through that.
The governor didn't want to pardon him. I mean, just to recall now, this is 9 African-American men and 1 woman wrongfully convicted, as we ultimately learned, and sentenced for burning a white-owned grocery store, eventually pardoned in 2012, but Governor Hunt declined to pardon them.
He did, yeah. He struggled with it, and we spent many late hours discussing this at the mansion. It was tough for me because I really, really pushed him hard to pardon it. But I had others in the cabinet who said, "You can't do that. You just can't." Politically, I understood it, because had he done that, it could have been disastrous for him in the legislature. And my compromise was to some of the people who were really upset, You either want this man to be the kind of governor who can respond to many, many other issues, or you want to destroy him before he can, and then you'll be the first ones to come back and criticize him. We were able to put it to rest. He just felt he could not do the pardon, but everybody got out of jail with the exception of Ben Chavis. I talked with Ben many years later, and Ben was not bitter about that not happening, and we still have a very good relationship.
But it speaks to what you were referred to earlier, this challenge of working inside the system and understanding how things work politically, having come from the outside when you were, you know, walking into bathrooms and getting beaten up and challenging the general about whether you're going to sit at the and get a cup of coffee. All from the outside. Now you're inside, and it's a different picture.
It is a totally different picture, and it took me a while, Frank, to really learn that. You know, go back to the mayor's position. When I was running for mayor, I had been offered a position as a faculty member at the University of North Carolina. I was at Duke at the time. And the chancellor, Lyle Citizen at the time, said, I want to suspend any discussions until after the mayor's race. We did that. But he said that would have no bearing on whether or not you become a faculty member. After the mayor's race and I was elected, then the whole game plan changed, and there was an unwillingness on the part of the trustees to appoint me a faculty member. That angered me, and it angered a lot of people, but it angered me more. And I hadn't really come to grips with the fact that as mayor, you can't say what you think always. And I was making a speech, and I referred to Governor Bob Scott at the time as a Southern Democratic bigot. And that almost ruined me. It almost ruined me with my supporters in Chapel Hill. It certainly sent shockwaves around the state. And luckily, I survived that.
And you did apologize.
I did apologize profusely. Yeah, I apologized. And that reinforced the need to understand how to balance things within the system and still be effective and don't close off doors to yourself. That comes from not having the years of experience of contact, like a Jim Hunt who grew up in this. I didn't grow up in it, so I had to have a crash course on how to behave as a politician in the mix of things.
I was going to say, Howard, you talked about the anger you had, but in all the times I've heard you speak in recent years, and certainly during this program, I hear any sense of betrayal of anger or just resentment. And now, of course, nobody can go through their whole lives holding that anger and resentment. But given what you've gone through and given what you've seen in your life, anger and resentment don't seem to be part of your makeup, your persona.
No, it's not. It really isn't. I think that you can't keep looking back and blaming others for the experiences that you were either denied or prevented from accessing, because I think in the end it all boils down to what the individual is capable of doing and taking full advantage of what is accessible in being able to use as a stepping stone, as opposed to being completely relegated to stumbling over things as stumbling blocks that just don't make sense. And so I have been asked the question many times, if you could change your life and redesign how you got here, would you change it? And when I look back on it, my position is absolutely not. I think the experiences I've had have been such a positive experience because it has impacted the lives of a lot of people, and I was able to survive it, and I think I was left here for a purpose to do that.
Let me be more specific and talk to you about particularly changes in the voting laws. What do you think?
I think what is going on with the voter ID process is not very helpful. I think it's discouraging to a lot of people, and I sometimes think maybe the proponents of this are doing that for that specific purpose. It does remind me a little of the Jim Crow days when Reconstruction was coming to an end and every roadblock was being created to prevent people from having easy access. I think the whole idea of cutting down on the number of voting days is very much in that area. I don't know how people can rationally think we can vote all of the people we would like to have vote in one day. This population has just bloomed in terms of the numbers of people. Therefore, we need to accommodate that number by opening up much broader opportunities like some of the foreign countries have done, who are not very democratic, but who are behaving more democratically than we are.
We saw earlier this week when Thad Cochran was reelected in Mississippi with the votes of African-American Democrats, which is just a remarkable situation. But the day of the runoff, the Tea Party campaign backing Chris McDaniel sent people to the predominantly black voting precincts and had people there as, quote, observers. And, you know, you wonder about between the voter ID laws that so many state capitals are instituting around the country and these polling observers, it just sounds like a clear intimidation. And, you know, you wonder why Republicans around the country said, why can't we do better with the African-American vote? Why can't we get black support, Hispanic vote, Latino vote, and minorities vote? And then you see events like this and situations like that, and you say, well, here's why.
Absolutely. And I'm really shocked because Republicans have had a really great opportunity to expand its voting base. The Democratic Party, at least in North Carolina, is in a little disarray right now. And I think if these Republican leaders in North Carolina were smart, they would have seized the opportunity to be more open and more inviting to minorities, especially blacks. You know, what so amazes me is that when I grew up, the first vote I ever cast was for Republican, because the Republican Party was the saving party for those of us who recognized that Lincoln had freed the slaves and the Republicans had been progressive, even here in North Carolina. I just find it really disconcerting that they haven't been able to take full advantage of it. But it's interesting what did occur in Mississippi.
Howard Lee, thank you so very much for talking with us.
Well, I'm delighted. Thank you for inviting me.
And Ken Rudin, always a pleasure.
My pleasure, too. Thank you, Frank. And thank you, Howard.
Thank you, Ken.
Howard Lee, former mayor of Chapel Hill, served in several capacities in the state of North Carolina in his years of public service to our state. Ken Rudin, the political junkie. Just ahead, the music of Skylar Gudas. Stay tuned.